Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. In today's program, we're going to look at financial crises from the early 1600s to present. What causes them? What are their effects? And what can be done to prevent them? Please stay tuned for this edition of History Counts, Manias, Panics, and Crashes. Welcome back to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we're going to look at the long history of financial crises. What caused them? What were the consequences? And what might they tell us about our present and future economic situation? To help us understand financial crises, we're very happy to have with us Professor Robert Z. Alaber. Professor Alaber was on the faculty of the University of Chicago from 1965 and is now retired. He taught international finance there. He's been a visiting professor at Williams, Brandeis, Dartmouth's Amos Tuck School of Business, and the London Business School. He's also consulted for the Federal Reserve System's Board of Governors, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and other agencies. Professor Alaber is the author of numerous books on financial subjects, including the national and international monetary system and personal finance. Additionally, Professor Alaber substantially updated the classic history of financial crises, entitled Manias, Panics, and Crashes, by Charles P. Kindleberger, for its fifth edition, published by Wiley in 2005. Thanks very much for being with us today, Professor Alaber.
It's a pleasure for me to join you.
Professor Alaber, what are manias and how do they relate to bubbles?
All bubbles are manias, but all manias are not necessarily bubbles. Financial bubble involves making a forecast of the price tomorrow or the price at the end of the week based on the increase in the price from the previous several days. So people extrapolate price changes, and that process becomes continuous, and at times it accelerates.
You say there's a euphoria that is associated with the phenomenon of bubbles.
People become wealthier and wealthier. They believe they're smarter and smarter, and more people who had not initially been participating in the purchase of assets begin to participate in the purchase of assets because it seems like almost anyone can make a lot of money relatively easily.
So people are looking at a short-term capital gains rather than investing for the long haul.
They may not make that distinction, but the observers among us believe that they are investing, certainly for the short term. They may think that the prices will continue until they reach the sky.
And bubbles seem to be associated with something that can be called a shock to the economic system. It might be the rapid expansion of the railways in the 19th century or the communication revolution of the 90s or even a deregulation such as the 99 repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act.
These bubbles are often associated with financial innovation, a change in regulations, or a new technological development that appears to be sufficiently important so that it's going to change the rates of return and the rates of economic growth.
What type of an event can occur which would cause the bursting of a bubble?
Well, bubbles burst in part because regulations change and the authorities decide that asset prices have increased too rapidly, or they decide to, as in 1979, to change monetary policy in order to stem the inflation. And occasionally they may burst simply because investors get tired and the more and more investors decide that perhaps prices have risen sufficiently rapidly and some take their money and want to put it at a safer location.
Is it sometimes associated with the failure of a prominent firm?
The triggers rarely come about because a prominent firm fails, but the implosion of the bubble may lead to a failure of the prominent firm. For example, house prices in the U.S. have been declining for almost 2 years, but it was only after a year of the declines in house prices that a prominent firm actually went under. And the first of those firms was Bear Stearns. It was 18 months before the second prominent firm, Lehman Brothers, went under.
Now, once the bubble bursts, asset prices start to fall, and you talk about something called a feedback loop.
Well, the asset prices first fall gradually. Only a few people are cautious, but then as asset prices fall, a larger number of people decide maybe that it's time for them to take their profits, and the only way to take their profits is to sell the assets, and so prices fall more rapidly. And then the information that the prices are falling leads to an even larger number of investors to sell. So that's part of the feedback loop. The second part of the feedback loop is the impact on the real economy. As assets fall, household wealth declines, and individuals spend less, and a recession almost always follows.
Is there a tendency in this price fall for prices to overshoot a target and fall even further than economic conditions would warrant?
There is often a sort of undershooting of the equilibrium, just as there had been sort of overshooting of the long-run equilibrium price when the bubble was accelerating. But the undershooting tends to be modest compared with the scope of the overshooting, unless the bubble is associated with a surge in the price of a currency in the exchange market, for example, the Mexican peso in 1994. And then when the bubble burst, the peso depreciated very, very sharply.
Now, bubbles have been with us a very long time. And the book Manias, Panics, and Crashes, one of the early bubbles that you write about, it has to do with the tulip bubble of 1636 in Holland. Could you talk about the tulip bubble?
Yes. All of a sudden, investors became interested in tulips. Tulip prices are rising. What made that bubble unique and different from the bubbles that we've seen in recent years is that the buyers of the tulips needed credit, and they got the credit from the sellers of the tulips. Currently, in the most recent bubbles, the sources of credit are from the banks and other lenders, but not usually from the sellers of the assets.
I understand that people were buying tulips even before they had flowered, or they were still in the ground?
They were essentially buying the tulips in the ground on the presumption that they would take possession at some distant time, that is, in several months after the tulips had begun to grow.
And you're right that people were putting down homes and other valuables as down payments on these unbloomed tulips.
Yes. When a bubble occurs, many investors are willing to make very large bets. There was a bubble in Albania in the 1990s. Bank deposits were paying very high interest rates, and many expatriate Albanians in New York and in Rome, in Germany, moved funds into Albania to participate in the bubble. Some of the individuals in Albania sold their houses in order to get cash to participate in the bubble.
In the case of Holland, how long was the economy affected after the tulip bubble burst?
Well, that's a matter of debate among economists and historians, but certainly 3 or 4 years.
And then we also saw examples of bubbles in stock speculation in the early days in London and Paris with the South Sea and Mississippi bubbles.
Yes, that was a unique event or a unique set of events in that we had two bubbles in adjoining countries within a matter of a few months of each other, and both of them involved an innovation that money could be made in exploration in very distant lands.
Well, you mentioned in the book there are a total of 10 financial crises from 1816 to 1929.
Yes.
What triggered those crises? I think people would be surprised to learn how many crises we've had in our history.
Yes, but we want to make a distinction between bubbles and crises. All bubbles end in crises, but not all crises are preceded by a bubble. So a crisis might be triggered by the failure of a large bank, or a crisis might be triggered by a very abundant supply of agricultural products. A very rich harvest will lead to downward pressure on farm prices, and that downward pressure will mean that the borrowers will not have the income to repay the lenders, and then the stability of the lenders, that is, of the banks, won't be in doubt. And so we had panics.
With respect to the 19th century crises, that railroads, overinvestment in railroads seemed to play an important role, and
yes.
Land speculation.
Yes, land speculation can always be a major source of bubbles. The cliche is land's a great investment. They're not making any more of it. But what the investors fail to realize is that in the long run, the real rate of return on land is more or less equal to the interest rate.
I see. So over time, land is not going to move up faster than consumer prices generally?
No, land will move up. Assume the consumer price level were zero. constant, no change in the inflation rate, the price of land would rise by about the interest rate.
Now, in the case of railroads, would be the problem relate to the fact that a lot of money was attracted to the possibility of making money in railroading, and that eventually you'd have more railroads than you needed?
Yes, there would be overinvestment in railroads. The sort of initially, of course, the railroad investments would be highly profitable, and profitable investments attract followers, and then there is ends up being too much investment. There's an analogy with the dot-com boom of the 1990s. Initially, some of the firms were fabulously profitable. One thinks of Microsoft or Dell or Cisco, and then these firms invite imitators and followers, and then the supply of dot-com stocks surges, and eventually that bubble was burst.
Do people keep putting money into these new industries even when it looks like the profits are falling in the hope that they're going to be the next Cisco?
Some people do, and then there will be that the initial decline in the price is modest and will be reversed. But eventually these people lose much of the money that they have invested.
Now, you mentioned real estate in connection with the 1920s. What role did real estate play leading up to the Depression of the 30s?
Real estate prices increased by 50% in the late 1920s. The country was growing very rapidly. The credit was abundantly available. And then when the stock prices began to fall and the economy softened, real estate prices began to soften. We had most of the mortgages at that time were fixed. That is, they were not amortizing.
So you didn't liquidate your mortgage over time? It just stayed there?
No, you simply paid the interest on the mortgage, and at the end of 5 years, you were obliged to take out a new loan for the mortgage.
For the full amount, so you really never paid it off.
Yeah, exactly. But one of the problems was that when the mortgage came due, the lender often was bankrupt. And that meant that the borrower could not obtain the cash to repay the lender. And the borrower became a distressed seller of the real estate. And that contributed significantly to the decline in real estate prices during that period.
So distressed selling is a real characteristic of a financial crisis.
Yes, and that is what is happening. It has been happening in the United States since early October. There's been distressed selling of real estate, and there's been distressed selling by the hedge funds, who had levered portfolios that they had borrowed money. And the assumption was that they would have high rates of return because they were earning, let's say, 8% and only paying 4% or 5% on their borrowed money. But then asset prices began to decline, and some of the investors wanted their money back, and they became distressed sellers. And that's put significant downward pressure on stock prices.
So even a prudent buyer may end up in trouble as distressed assets, say in housing, go into the market and his house falls precipitously in value.
Yes, the innocent get punished because they are investing alongside people who are greedy and who are reaching for spectacular gains. So that if you live in a neighborhood in which there have been significant speculative purchases of real estate, they've driven up the prices have increased sharply, and then when the bubble bursts, the innocent people in that neighborhood find that the non-speculators find that the market value of their houses has declined very sharply, and some of them may be underwater. That is, the amount they owe on their property may be larger than the market value of the home.
Now, stocks also played an important role in the 30s depression. How did that bubble form?
The U.S. was growing very rapidly in the 1920s, from 1921 on, and there were lots of new industries, automobiles, the telephone, consumer durables, the feel-good sense of the economy. And then from 1927 on through the last several months of 1929, stock prices nearly tripled.
Now, what caused the bubble to burst in 1929?
Well, the Federal Reserve was tightening policy, and that may have been one of the factors. The second factor was that the real economic growth was slowing, so that automobile production had slowed significantly before the bubble in stocks burst.
So the stock market rally was really not reflective of what was going on in the real economy in terms of production.
Well, when the real economy is doing well. Stocks often do well, but one could argue that in some cases the increase in stock prices is disproportionately high relative to the increase in production in the real economy. That's when the mania in stocks takes over. That clearly is what happened in the real estate markets in some of our more rapidly growing states, in Florida, in Nevada, in parts of California, in the last several years, that is, from 2002 to 2006.
Now, the stock market, the peak from in 1929 was not recovered until 1954, 25 years later. Why was the slump so prolonged after the 29 crash?
Well, there was a marked distrust of stocks throughout the 1930s. And then we had World War II, which took up the first 4 or 5 years of the 1940s. And investors after the war were remindful that after World War I, stock prices declined sharply. And so investors were reluctant to buy stocks, even though the real economy was increasing at a very rapid rate in the 1940s, and corporate profits were growing at a rapid rate.
Are there any steps that the government could have taken in the early phase of the Depression that could have significantly shortened the slump?
Oh, that's a long and involved question.
Well, let's look at it this. Could we discuss these two schools of thought, the let the fire burn out sort of point of view and the provide liquidity, rush
exactly.
to rescue?
That's the debate. And that's the debate that is now ongoing in the United States. Should the authorities allow house prices to decline to their, let's say, their long-run equilibrium value? Or should they provide abundant amounts of credit so that house prices fall less extensively than they otherwise would have?
What is the justification for the let the fire burn out school of thought that I think Andrew Mellon, Hoover's Treasury Secretary, advocated?
Yes, well, he would say there was rot in the economy, and it's only if asset prices fall very sharply that this rot will be exterminated. The counter-argument goes back to an exchange we had a few minutes ago. There are lots of innocent people out there who are being punished by the decline in asset prices, even though they would not be considered among the greedy that had led to the significant increase in the prices of real estate or of stocks.
And there is a history, as I learned from manias, panics, and crashes, going back certainly to the 19th century and maybe earlier, of the government and large financial institutions intervening in the market with guarantees. I think the Baring case comes to mind, where the British government helped organize other institutions, private institutions, to ensure the stability of the system. So that was a kind of intervention, I suppose.
Yes, governments frequently have intervened to try to prevent runs on the banking system. We developed clearinghouse certificates, forms of near money in the United States, near money that was superior to the claims on the banks. So government, whenever there is a crisis of this sort, governments are mindful of the consequences of the continuing sharp decline in asset prices, and they try to adopt measures that almost always involve the provision of credit that are intended to dampen the decline in asset prices.
Now, if we could move abroad, Japan, which is the world's second largest economy, experienced a bubble bursting in 1989.
The bubble actually began to burst in 1990. The Japanese bubble involved both surges in real estate prices and surges in stock prices. And to some extent, the surges in real estate prices provided the wherewithal for the surge in stock prices. That was in part because many of the firms listed on the Tokyo Stock Exchange own real estate. So when real estate prices increased, their market value increased. You could almost think of that as a form of double counting, since the price of the real estate that they owned increased and the prices of their stocks owned by individual investors and by banks increased. But that was primarily a real estate bubble.
What was the effect on the Japanese economy when the bubble burst?
Japan had three recessions in 10 years, and for perhaps 15 years, it was a very slow growth economy, an average growth rate of 1 to 1.5% per year, even though the potential growth rate of the Japanese economy, that is the growth in its output capacity, is about 2% a year. So the descriptive term is that for this extended period, the Japanese economy was in economic doldrums.
Did they have an increase in unemployment?
They had an increase in unemployment, which was high by Japanese standards. In the 1880s, the Japanese unemployment rate would have been in the range of 2%, and it got up to sort of 4%.
You say that just about all of the Japanese banks became insolvent as the asset prices declined. How did the government deal with the insolvency of the banks?
The Japanese government made it clear that no bank would be allowed to fail with a loss to depositors. Not everyone believed that statement, so some large firm moved money out of the Japanese banks. But the historical evidence is that no depositor incurred a loss, even though the Japanese banks had significant negative net worth. So they implicitly had a government guarantee of the value of their deposits.
Did they let any of the banks fail?
Eventually, some of the banks failed, and others were merged. And so the failure of the banks led to the virtual wipeout of the value of the stocks of the investors who owned shares in those banks.
Can we learn anything from the Japanese experience?
Well, we've learned a lot from the Japanese experience, and the most important thing we've learned is that it's important for the government to take action decisively and soon, and especially to ensure that the investors believe that the banks will not be allowed to fail because they have the implicit capital of the government, and that the banks believe that they have sufficient capital so that they feel comfortable in making loans to various borrowers. Japan had a credit crunch, and we're going through a bit of that phenomena currently. The government is providing capital to 100, 200 U.S. banks to ensure that they will not fail, but we're at the stage now in which the banks are still reluctant to make loans.
If the financial crisis we're in now and the seizing up or the problems in our credit system is brought on by overexpansion of money or too much credit, can confidence be restored by increasing the liquidity in the economy?
It's unlikely. The increase in the liquidity of the economy will reduce the likelihood of a panic, but it's not going to restore confidence. What we're going to observe for the next year or two is that home prices in many parts of the country will continue to decline, and the decline in home prices will mean a decline in the net worth of households, and that's going to be very hard to offset. So we'll have a lot of liquidity that will prevent the collapse of the banking system, but at the same time, we may see that confidence diminishes, though it likely will diminish at a diminishing rate.
How severe do you think the current financial crisis is relative to previous ones?
Well, there's several different ways of measuring severity. If we think of measuring severity in terms of the increase in the unemployment rate, the Great Depression, when the unemployment rate got to 20 or 25%, we're unlikely to see anything of that sort. In the Great Depression, the collapse of the banks, the failure of the banks, led to a significant decline in the consumer price level. That's unlikely to happen. But the loan losses and the loss of capital by the banks is going to be very large by historical standards, although and probably as large relative to the total capital of the banks as occurred in the 1930s.
Would you think it's possible that the slump that's following this financial crisis could endure as long as the slump following the 29 crash?
Highly unlikely. We will have much more activist government than we did in the 1930s.
Do you think that the government should or should have been playing a role in preventing the development of the current bubble?
Yes. I think the government, in several different ways, should have recognized that house prices were far too high relative to their long-run equilibrium value, that at some stage that bubble would burst, and when that bubble burst, the lenders would be in financial difficulty, and therefore the government should have adopted several different types of measures to limit the increase in bank credit for real estate.
How about the proliferation of the derivatives instruments, including credit default swaps? Did that play a significant role?
Well, it probably contributed. Anything that makes credit more readily available obviously contributes to the increase in asset prices. But if one asks the question, if we had not had these esoteric instruments, would we have had a significant increase in asset prices of a magnitude comparable to a bubble? The answer almost certainly is yes.
You have a great quote. The efforts of central bankers to limit and control the growth of the money supply have been offset in part by the development of new substitutes for money, end quote.
Yes.
So it seems there's no end to inventiveness when it comes to financial instruments.
Yes, it costs very little to invent and it costs very little to copy.
Well, finally, based upon what we've learned from these previous financial crises, what steps do you think would be most effective in bringing about a recovery from the current crisis, in addition to making more money available to shore up the banking system?
Well, we want to be sure that the banks are well capitalized and that the fear that there might be a run on the banks because they're insufficiently capitalized, that fear is de minimis. We want to take measures to ensure that there is not an excessive amount of foreclosures because the banks are too slow to recognize that the buyers of the homes overpaid, but nevertheless have sufficient income to carry the mortgage at a reduced value for the mortgage. Some foreclosures lead to an unnecessary removal of the family for the home, and the government should encourage a renegotiation of the terms of the mortgage if the family has sufficient income to satisfy the mortgage at a new and lower value consistent with the market value of the home.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today, Professor Alibar. You're listening to History Counts, and we've been speaking about the history of financial crises with Professor Robert Z. Alibar, co-author of the fifth edition of the classic work, Manias, Panics, and Crashes. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to History Counts. In 1902, Theodore E. Burton published an economic history of the United States entitled Financial Crises and Periods of Industrial and Commercial Depression. Mr. Burton's book is of extraordinary interest because it describes in detail several depressions that the United States experienced prior to the Great Depression of the 1930s. For example, in 1818, the United States suffered a severe depression attended by high unemployment and the worst deflation in real estate in the 19th century. Much like the current crisis, the 1818 depression was brought on by overexpansion of the money supply, which in turn created a real estate bubble and contributed to huge trade deficits. Fortunately, this depression, although sharp, was brief. By the 1820s, growth resumed. The recovery was at least in part due to the completion of huge infrastructure projects, like the Erie Canal, which contributed greatly to the nation's productivity. The depression that followed the American Civil War was another story. This depression was largely due to speculation in railroads and was touched off by a banking panic in 1873. Unlike the 1818 depression, high levels of business failures and unemployment continued for years. Attempts at recovery were derailed in 1884 and again in 1893 by more bank failures, and it was not until 1897 that stable growth resumed. Until the 1930s, the 23-year period from 1873 to 1896 was referred to as the Great Depression. Thank you for joining us. History Counts is broadcast on the first Thursday of the month at 12:30 p.m. and on the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. It's produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.